State University. Young is somebody who needs no introduction to most of us, I'm sure, so I'll be very brief in introducing her. She is professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and she's the author of numerous influential works of political theory, which include Justice and the Politics of Difference, which was published in 1990 by Princeton University Press, Throwing Like a Girl, and Other Essays in Feminist Philosophy and Social Theory, which was also published in 1990. Intersecting Voices, Dilemmas of Gender, Political Philosophy, and Policy, which was published by Princeton in 1997, and Inclusion and Democracy, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2000. Professor Young's visit today is part of the Political Theory Colloquium, which is sponsored by the Department of Political Science. It's also the first event in this year's Mershon Citizenship Speaker Series. Young's talk is titled Responsibility and Global Justice, and it is subtitled A Social Connection Model.
Well, thank you very much, Clarissa. It's a great pleasure to be here and to see some old faces and meet some new people. I'm delighted. It's not my first visit to Columbus. I actually used to live in Ohio. I taught for 3 years, among the many places I taught for 3 years at Miami University in the southwest corner of the state. And once in a while, we'd come to Columbus or go to Dayton or often to Cincinnati, anything to get out of Oxford, the way I felt at the time. At the time, it was a dry city. You could only buy 3-2 beer in a... we even went to Indiana to get liquor.
Did this improve the quality of your undergraduate courses?
Absolutely, no question. What I'm going to do today is part talk about I did send ahead a paper that some people have read and some haven't. I'm not presuming anybody has. But it is the basis of this lecture, and of course I can't possibly present everything in it. So to compromise, trying to give you its basic argument, I'm going to talk for a while and then read for a while from the paper, because I would like to read those portions that are the core normative theory, and I'm afraid I'll misphrase it for myself if I don't read it. This is a part of a larger project. We always say that. In this case, I'm trying to think about structural injustice, and in a moment I'll briefly explain what I mean by that, and ask how we, and I think this does fit your theme of citizenship, how individual agents, and those might be individual persons or they might be organizations, ought to think about our responsibilities in relation to structural social injustice. That's the guiding question. And as you'll see, I believe that there are puzzles, normative and conceptual puzzles, that question generates, that the political theorist on a white horse can rush in and try to solve. So my claim, one claim I want to start with here, has to do, in this talk, as announced, I want to talk about structural injustice in global terms. And the claim, first, I want to briefly state, will be to counteract what many philosophers and political theorists still hold, that the scope of obligations of justice extends only as far as those who are dwelling in the same nation state. It's still commonly held both by ordinary citizens and by theorists and philosophers that there may be obligations that human beings have to one another across borders, but they aren't so thick and strong as obligations of justice. And I want to suggest that that's not so. And commonly, I think that most who hold that position philosophically assume that it is the dwelling together in under the same political constitution that generates the obligations of justice. I was just reading I'm going to a conference at Bowling Green State University after I leave here, and I was just reading the contribution that Samuel Freeman is making to that conference, in which he rearticulates this position on behalf of Rawls from his point of view, that it is the basic structure as interpreted by Freeman is constituted by the political constitution of a society, and that's what generates obligations of justice. I think this is wrong, that what generates obligations of justice is structural social processes, or the fact that people are cooperating together in social and economic terms, whether or not they're living under a common political constitution. So this way of thinking of it, I think, says there are ways that people interact in terms of social interaction and economic relations that are liable to generate conflict and possible inequalities and forms of domination. And it is the fact of the interaction and the social connection produced by economic processes that itself generates obligations of justice, because it generates the possibilities for injustice, harms of that sort. Unfair terms of social cooperation is the way that Rawls puts it. And that this then generates the need for political institutions in order to regulate the social and economic processes that have both produced the scope of those with whom one has obligations of justice and the possibilities of injustice. If one looks at it that way, then it's very plausible to say that there are transnational or even global obligations of justice that people have in one place in relation to others in different places. Because, on this very sketchy way I'm saying this now, because I want to come to the main argument about responsibility, there are structural social processes in the world today that extend globally or transnationally. There are, I'm not the first to have said this and noticed it and noticed its implications for theorizing global justice. Charles Bites, Onora O'Neill, and Thomas Pogge are three philosophers that I draw on significantly who hold this sort of position. Bites, for example, in his landmark book, Political Theory and International Relations, argues that we dwell in an international society, even in the absence of a comprehensive political constitution to regulate that society. And what he means by dwelling in an international society, I am rearticulating as we stand in relationships with other people, many of them very far away, where we and they together are implicated in and help to produce and reproduce structural social processes that affect us all, but don't affect us all in the same way and do produce often inequalities or other forms of effects on people that might raise issues of justice. So Bites says that the ongoing processes of production, investment, and trade connect people in diverse regions of the world, and that these relations are often unequal in power and material resources, and that principles of justice for this reason ought to apply transnationally. And I am endorsing this view. I want to put it in terms of structural, I want to call it structural injustice. And by using that term, I distinguish it from perhaps two other, maybe these are exhaustive forms of injustice. But we can think of injustices as coming to people, wrongs coming to people anyhow, moral harms coming to people by virtue of their interaction with other particular agents. And that's a form of a moral wrong anyhow that some people will refer to as injustice that isn't a structural injustice. If, for example, now I'm going to introduce the paper here reflects on the circumstances of the global apparel industry and the anti-sweatshop movement that recently has surfaced in the United States and other parts of the world in response to what are thought to be injustices suffered particularly by workers in the global apparel industry or other labor-intensive, multinational, corporate-dominated industries of the world. The paper reflects on this as an example to think through some of these questions. So if we distinguish there between what a boss in on a factory floor might do to one of the largely female workers in a small apparel manufacturer in Malaysia or Indonesia might threaten her with beating if she's trying to organize a union. I'm going to call that an example of interactive injustice. On the other hand, when we talk about injustice, often we're referring to what states do that is directly repressive or directly violating of rights. That's certainly a way of thinking about injustice. When you have dictators that jail people without trial, that's unjust. Or you can talk about states having policies or laws that are unjust. That's another form of injustice. But structural injustice, I want to distinguish from those two types. And I define first, I want to define briefly what I'm taking social structures to consist in to get on the way to what structural injustice is. Social structures, and part of the project of this book is to do a whole chapter trying to articulate what social structures are and what structural injustice is. So for the purposes of this, it's background to get to my argument about responsibility. But it is necessary because, as you'll see, the puzzle that I want to try to address with an alternative concept of responsibility requires assuming something about the way structures are related to individual action. So just briefly, structures concern both the rules and norms that people take as constraining and guiding their actions, as they both constrain and maybe offer opportunity. That's one segment. But also together with the aggregate effects of many people behaving under the guidance of the rules and norms of the institutions that serve as background to their action. And together with, so it's a aggregative definition, if you will, together with the material effects of the history of those actions. In one way of thinking about that portion of it, in any city in the United States, there are material effects of structural processes that have produced housing opportunities and constraints or other forms of planning geographic opportunities and constraints that are not easy to change. It's not impossible. And that's because they've become materialized in things and physical structures. So there's when I use the term structure, there is a literalness to it as well as thinking about how the acceptance and behavior in accordance with rules and norms is reproduced over time and has aggregative effects. I follow Anthony Giddens in wanting to say that there's nothing reified about social structural processes in these sense. That is, it's not as though they are entities that exist independently of individual actions. Giddens talks about structuration to describe this. Structures are all produced by the actions of individual persons, but in consort and in relation to one another. But when people act, this is what the theory of structuration says, they act with the assumption of the structures being as they are, that there is a kind of reification in people's own consciousness when they assume what the norms are and what the bases of action are. And that itself, that assumption, helps reproduce the structures. But also, along with Alex Wendt, I think even though the theory of structuration is correct, that it's important not to try to reduce the phenomena or the results or the problems that I want to suggest are generated by structural social processes back down to understanding them only in terms of individuals and individual interactions. And this is often the impulse. This is often what people try to do. Alex Wendt talks about this as an emergent reality, and I think that's right, that there is a way to treat the results or the operations of social structures on their own terms as having something like a causative meaning. That's very brief. In order to come to the concept of a structural injustice, as distinct from the other two kinds of injustice that I briefly talked about, an interactive type and the type that's directly produced by state policy or state. Structural injustice exists when the combined operations of institutions, of actions within institutions, put categories of persons, people who occupy particular positions in the structures, where people might move in and out, individuals might move in and out of those positions, but there are positions in the structures that suffer a systematic threat of domination or deprivation of the means to develop and exercise their capacities at the same time as they enable others to dominate and give them abundance of power. Structural injustice is a kind of inequality, but it isn't a one-time or about one issue kind of inequality. It's a systematic inequality which renders persons who occupy positions in the structures in relation to others who occupy different positions, and those who they are may change, but the positions remain, or they change in structural terms, but they're fairly constant. That those positions stand in a relation of inequality, one of privilege and disadvantage, one of vulnerability and others that are to whom they're vulnerable or on whom they tend to be dependent. Let me now fill this out a little bit with the example of the apparel industry. I'm using the example of sweatshops as an example of global structural injustice, or global level. It's transnational for sure. It doesn't exist everywhere. Now, I'll briefly say what I mean by a sweatshop, but this is a common parlance. It's not any old factory. Not any old production facility is properly called sweatshop. This is a kind, it describes production facilities with certain kinds of conditions that most people agree, I think, tend to violate human rights in one way or another. And as this anti-sweatshop movement, in the years 1999 to 2000, was there activity here at OSU in relation to the university done by students? That was the big year across the United States. But, of course, the movement has been, I don't know, 15 years before then, and is still going. As the movement began more and more investigating where there are production facilities of the sort that I'll describe, they found more and more that they're not only over there, but over here, to Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, big cities, even Toronto. I always think of Canada as, you know, only next to Sweden. but there it is. And the kinds of conditions that are typical, and the paper contains some footnotes to people who've studied these things. It's not only journalistic, it's pretty well documented. Very common in the apparel industry that the first line producers of apparel are working in very small facilities or out of their homes. Majority, almost entirely female, often very young, between 14 and 17 years, or somewhat older, some, but often very young, predominantly female, sometimes working out of their homes as ways of hiding the fact that they're working. Their husbands are embarrassed, you know. But if they're in facilities, then either way, usually working very long hours, 14 to 16 a day for 6 days is typical. And some of what I've read, it's not uncommon to be forced to work through the night when there's a large order to deliver rapidly. And in the apparel industry, there are often large orders to deliver rapidly because it's just-in-time production. So there is, then on the other hand, there might be some slack times, and there's no guarantee of income during slack times. It's typical for the equipment to be very poor or non-existent, for ventilation to be poor, for harassment, including sexual harassment, to be normal and part of the discipline of the workers, in that sense, systematic. You notice I haven't even mentioned wages. It's typical for there to be very few breaks in which one of the workers might be able to go to the bathroom or just have a rest. Exhaustion is common, and there can be, you know, ill health effects to not being able to go to the bathroom often enough, and so on. All of these are the sorts of conditions that I hope that most would agree are disturbing no matter where they take place. Unlike what might, where if one talks about living wages, what the standard is of a living wage can be quite variable across countries because of standards of living. But these other issues are not variable. Exhaustion is not too variable cross-culturally or by economic market relations. So those are the kinds of conditions that are called sweatshops. Now, the structure of the apparel industry is hugely complicated, and here's where we come to thinking about this as structural injustice. Most of the operators of these small factories are often themselves nearly poor. They're not rich people. It's not as though the Gap operates a factory in the Philippines directly. The large multinationals under whose label many of the garments that we buy are sold contract to distributors. They place an order, they say, find it. But they will have specifications. And the distributors, and there's middle people, right? You have U.S. distributors and you have the distributor in the Philippines. One of the papers I cite does a whole study just focusing on JCPenney, which does have a particular relationship with the Philippines. And so you'll have a set of middle people, and you might have your big multinational on top. Just placing orders is really the retailer from a legal point of view, not a producer. And there are several middle people that are distributors. And then you come to those who might be the larger contractor for ultimately contracting out work, orders that are for producers. And the small, at the bottom level there, the factory owners or operators are often themselves very much from their point of view under systems of constraint. They perceive themselves as toward the bottom of a big structure in which they themselves have relatively little power. And there's a lot of truth to it. If they will appeal, if one says, well, how can you do that? How can you make people work 14-hour days? They'll say, hey, look, you know, they come, people want these jobs. It's better than having no jobs at all. And I have no choice but to have people work long hours for the wages that I'm offering. If I don't, I am operating at the bare margin in my own operation. I'll be put out of business. There are 100 other guys who want to start a factory or are operating them. I'm in a very competitive situation. And the truth of the industry, as far as I've been able to tell from my reading, is this matches the constraints in the industry. It is a highly competitive industry. Most of the actors in it can say, if I don't do this, I'll be out of business. And they say it with some reason. This is a picture I'm trying to give of what structural constraint can feel like, and how it is that it operates that it structures incentives and disincentives. When people say, I'm forced to under circumstances of structural constraint, it isn't at all the same as having a gun to your head or not being physically capable of doing something. But there is a sense in which it's not a misuse of the term being forced. It's about constraint that's generated by the costs and benefits as perceived by the agents. And it is true that they will cease to have their position at all in the structure if they move too far. Now, one of the reasons that I've chosen the anti-sweatshop movement as an example is because an intuition was generated, I think, by the movement that looks to both purveyors or those more on the consumer end of this structural process, right? We have a global system of the apparel industry where there are different places in the world that might contribute to the assembly of the clothes we're wearing or the shoes we're wearing or the toys we buy or whatever it is. And the anti-sweatshop movement draws on an intuition that those who purchase or who are on the ordering end, such as college sports teams, of the apparel should be thought to be somewhat implicated in the working conditions of those at the other end. That's the intuition, I think, that the anti-sweatshop movement has called on. And if one phrases the way students might have been thought to be putting their protest at universities, for example, you see the students protesting, having hunger strikes, sitting in saying, you, university, should take responsibility for the conditions under which the clothing that you sell in your bookstores is manufactured in, say, Indonesia or Guatemala. And I think that's the kind of intuition they were raising. And at the same time, you can see what the response is. There's something puzzling about that claim if you listen to it. And indeed, much of the response to such a claim is, what are you saying? We had nothing to do with it. We didn't do it. We don't operate the sweatshops. How can you say it's our responsibility? It's them. there's blame. So this question of mine about responsibility and structural injustice is generated first by this clash of intuitions for me. On the one hand, I'm sympathetic to the intuitions of the movement. On the other hand, I think that the response that says, well, we have not operated these factories. We're not the public officials who have failed to enforce labor law. What do you mean we're responsible? Or if you think about activists who pass out flyers in front of stores, exhorting consumers to think about their responsibilities. And many what I find fascinating is many consumers are made uncomfortable by this. They do feel like there's something right. On the other hand, their reason might kick in and say, well, I have nothing to do with it. I haven't caused it. And here's where I want to say that we might need a different theory of responsibility to correspond to the intuition that there is some responsibility. My question is this. I stated it at the beginning, but I'll restate it now. How should individual agents think about our responsibilities in relation to structural injustice? I'm suggesting that the immediate workers who produce goods stand in a set of structures that the consumers of those goods also stand, and that those set of structures include all the people and all the agents and institutions that connect the actual makers to the people who purchase them. And this is, if we take the global apparel industry, a hugely complex set of structures. It's the way the world economic system works in a large respect today. And by what I said earlier, this means that we and they stand in a relationship by virtue of these social connections that generate obligations of justice between us. But my question, I think, presents a puzzle, like the one that I indicated by the response of university administrations, for example, to the claims of an anti-sweatshop movement. We can admit that we together contribute by our actions to the structural processes, but what we can't do is sort out the causal threads. I can admit that, yes, you know, I'm a consumer. I depend on the global apparel system for most of what I wear. I might knit something now and then, but otherwise, right? And in that sense, I can't deny that my actions in accepting that system and assuming and making choices that would look for the least expensive garments and so on. Through the system, others are making their decisions. I can't deny that my actions are contributing, that I'm participating in the structural processes. But I know that my contribution is very small, almost so small as to be negligible personally, and even more so, what I can't do, and any of us, and this is even true of larger, relatively large actors, I can't say that this worker in Guatemala suffers her injustice because of what I do. There's no direct causal thread I can trace. Because, as I mentioned earlier, I think the way to think about the causes of her injustice are structural to a large degree, rather than personal or even legal. It's that fact that creates the puzzle, as I see it, that there is, it's not possible to trace the relationship between me and those to whom I have an obligation, that puts into question a normal or more standard conception of responsibility like that to which the deniers are appealing to when they say, I didn't do it. So now this is what I want to do. I've come now to my main subject. The standard model of responsibility I call a liability model of responsibility, which has many uses. Let me make it clear from the start. I'm not wanting to ditch what I'm calling the liability model of responsibility. I'm only arguing that for understanding responsibility in relation to what I'm calling structural injustice, it's not very helpful, and we need another one. In order to answer my question, how should individuals think about our responsibilities in relation to the structural injustice? And we must have some. Let me make that parenthetical remark. I believe, along with Julius Sklar, for example, that there's a difference between saying someone suffers injustice and saying that they have a misfortune or that something's happening to them that's bad. If we simply say, well, you know, tough luck, then no agency is implicated. But if we say these people are suffering injustice, we're denying that it's just tough luck by implication, I think. We're saying, by implication, somebody ought to do something. It's wrong, and somebody ought to do something. And we're also implicitly claiming, I think, that there is a social cause for the wrong, for the harm. Well, then the question becomes, if somebody ought to do something, then the question is, who? And if it's structural injustice, part of the puzzle is, you can't pin the finger on who. So part of the theory here is to try to give a plausible answer to, in some sense, all of those who participate by their actions in the structures. Is who. To make that answer, I need to distinguish between what I'm calling a liability model of responsibility and what I will call here a social connection model of responsibility. The liability model is I use that label to describe all forms of assigning responsibility that either appeal to blame or fault, or what the law calls strict liability. If we take blame or fault first, the liability model requires first that you be able to trace that causal connection between that agent you are saying is responsible and the harm that you're trying to assign responsibility for. That's the first requirement. Generally speaking, in moral and legal theory, that's not sufficient, however, because the agent who is causally responsible might have been forced or completely ignorant that this was happening. So generally speaking, in moral and legal theory, on a liability model in this narrow sense first, it is causal responsibility plus voluntariness and sufficient information to assign responsibility in a moral or legal sense. And this same model of liability or blame-fault model can be applied to collective agents. Much of the literature that comes under the rubric of collective responsibility in business ethics and in philosophy argues that you can take whole organizations and consider them agents in the same way. And Peter French's work on collective responsibility was important for making the argument that corporations, for example, can be considered agents from this point of view. So what I'm calling a social connection model will be something quite different from collective responsibility as usually understood. Now, just to expand a little bit, in the law, there is a concept of strict liability, which I'm also including under the liability model of responsibility, and it has different forms. But one standard form of strict liability is to assign responsibility to an agent that is connected to what it is that caused a harm, but didn't himself or herself directly cause the harm. So, for example, when the tree from my yard fell on your roof, damaged your roof, and you need to pay for it, I am liable, strictly speaking, under the law for the payment of your roof because it's my tree, not because anybody thinks I did it, and I'm not to blame. I'm including that kind of liability as well as the kind of strict liability that sometimes is assigned to employers for the behavior of their employees and so on under the liability model. It still has the general form of we have to be able to trace that direct causal relationship between who it is we're assigning responsibility to and the harm we're trying to assign responsibility for, and there should be certain circumstances of voluntariness and inform. This model of responsibility, the liability model, has a place if we want to think about the harms and injustices that come to workers in poor production facilities in the apparel industry. No question about it. We should blame supervisors who beat up workers, and we should blame local governments that might turn a blind eye to violation of their own labor laws, for example. And apparently, according to my reading, the United States government does it a lot, turns a blind eye on these. Not enough inspectors. Then one can give a story of structural constraint, even to explain that. But there is a place for blaming and assigning liability to individual agents in this set of harms. My argument is that it's not sufficient for covering and thinking about what's required to remedy this kind of structural injustice. That's the argument. And that to do so, we have to move to another model of responsibility, which I call social connection. Now, what I want to do now is read for a while. I hope it's not going to take too long. Where I want to explain to you this social connection model. There's another one. I want to start with ordinary language. In ordinary language, we sometimes use the term responsible to refer to what I called under the liability model, being guilty or at fault for having caused a harm. Those of you who have the paper, I'm starting on page 25. But in ordinary language, we also use the term responsibility in some other ways. We might say that people have certain responsibilities by virtue of their social roles or positions, as when we say a teacher has specific responsibilities, or we appeal to our responsibilities as citizens. Now, in this meaning, finding responsible doesn't imply finding at fault or liable for a past wrong, but rather refers to agents carrying out activities in a morally appropriate way and aiming for certain outcomes. What I propose as a social connection model of responsibility draws more on this usage of the term responsibility than on the liability usage. It does share with a liability, but I am bridging, in a way. That task responsibility doesn't have the causal connection that liability model has. And the social connection model, as I'm conceptualizing it, does carry some causal relationship to the harm. The social connection model responsibility says that individuals bear responsibility for structural injustice because they contribute by their actions to the processes that produce the unjust outcomes. Our responsibility derives from belonging together with others in a system of independent processes of cooperation and competition through which we seek benefits and aim to realize projects. We, who are part of these processes, bear responsibility even though we cannot trace the outcome we may regret to our own particular actions in a direct causal chain. Within this scheme of social cooperation, and that's the Rawlsian phrase that I want to invoke, each of us expects justice toward ourselves, and others can legitimately make claims on us. Responsibility in relation to injustice thus derives not from living under a common constitution, but rather from participation in the diverse institutional processes that produce structural injustice. That's what I summarized earlier. In today's world, many of these structural processes extend beyond nation-state boundaries to include globally dispersed persons. I have five conceptual features of this social connection model. Let me see if I can list them first and then go through them. I'm going to argue, and the way I developed the idea of the social connection model is by contrasting it with the liability model. So unlike the liability model, I'm going to argue, the social connection model does not isolate perpetrators. And unlike the liability model, it doesn't assume background conditions as normal. Unlike the liability model, the social connection model is more forward-looking than backward-looking. Unlike the liability model, the social connection model is essentially, in this model, responsibility is essentially shared. And finally, on the social connection model, the responsibility can be discharged only through collective action, because that follows from its being shared. Let me go through each of these. The liability model of responsibility seeks to mark out and isolate those responsible, thereby distinguishing them from others who, by implication, are not responsible. Such isolation of the one or ones liable from the others is an important aspect of legal responsibility, as I talked about. Social practices of guilty, of finding guilty or finding faulty, of holding strictly liable, focus necessarily and importantly on particular agents in order to sanction or demand compensation from them and them alone. A system of moral rules of legal accountability should make clear that agents who violate the rules may face accusation as individual agents. When harms result from the participation of thousands or millions of people in institutions and practices that produce unjust results, on the other hand, such an isolating concept is inadequate. Where there are structural injustices, finding some people guilty of perpetrating specific wrongs doesn't absolve others whose actions contribute to the outcome from bearing responsibility. And so this is, even if we find even if we say the factory operator is to blame for certain specific wrongs that happen to certain specific individuals, that doesn't itself absolve others from being responsible in relation to the structural processes that constrain the actions of the operator. So both can operate simultaneously. And the idea here is that on a liability model, when you find some guilty, implicitly you're finding others innocent. But on the social connection model, finding that some are responsible doesn't necessarily absolve others. The second condition. In a liability concept of responsibility, what counts as a wrong for which we seek a perpetrator and for which he or she might be required to compensate, we generally conceive as the deviation from a baseline. Implicitly, we assume a normal background situation that's morally acceptable, if not ideal. A crime, for example, or an actionable harm, consists in a morally and legally unacceptable deviation from a background structure. The liability model considers the process that brought about the harm as a discrete bounded event that breaks away from an ongoing, normal, and implicitly acceptable flow. Punishment, redress, or compensation aims to restore normality or make whole, as we say in the law, in relation to this baseline of circumstances. So I'm still on the liability model. The model of responsibility deriving from an understanding the mediated connection that agents have to structural injustice, on the other hand, evaluates not harm that deviates from the normal and the acceptable, but rather brings into question precisely the background conditions that ascriptions of blame or fault assume as normal. When we judge that structural injustice exists, we mean that at least some of the normal and accepted background conditions of actions are not morally acceptable. Most of us contribute to a greater or lesser degree to the production and reproduction of structural injustice precisely because we follow the accepted and expected rules and conventions of the communities and institutions in which we act. Usually we enact these conventions and practices in a habitual way. So now let me give an example drawn from the sweatshop example. The fashion system is part of the conditions that create the global apparel industry. Fashion and its seasons is one set of practices that most producers and consumers assume as a background condition in the societies we live in. It's not just that I need clothes, but I need new clothes, even though I have perfectly good clothes at home. Right? And there's a whole advertising and sale industry devoted to making, enjoying fashion and style. And these are part of the accepted background conditions globally for apparel. And normally these don't come into question, they're just assumed. But it is a contributor. The whole fashion system is a contributor. Executives at major retailers such as Nike, Benetton, or Calvin Klein typically devote more attention and money to advertising to promote the image of the company, its fashionability, its stylishness, than to paying the workers who make the clothes or to doing something to ensure that they work under safe and humane conditions. It's normal in this society for companies to devote a large portion of their investment to advertising rather than production. Levels of unemployment in many places where sweatshops exist are normally high, another example of normal background conditions. And the social processes depriving peasants of the means to make an independent livelihood speedily create more unemployed. One should expect under these circumstances that private enterprises with super exploited sweatshop openings, that for every opening, this sentence is a little complicated to speak, I don't know why, but the idea is simple. It's part of the normal background conditions of especially these less developed societies in which many of these sweatshops spring up, that there will be 100 people for every opening of one of these awful jobs. Why is that? Because there's a whole set of structural processes that's making them unemployed. And the same is true of Los Angeles, for the same reasons, right? A lot of migration can happen from the countryside to the city in the Philippines or from Mexico to Los Angeles. So the point here is that if we want to think about responsibility in relation to structural processes, what we need to do is bring forward what's usually thought of as acceptable background conditions. The third condition is the social connection model is more forward-looking than backward-looking. Assigning responsibility, whether under the liability model or under the social connection model, always has some backward-looking and forward-looking aspects. No concept of responsibility is lacking in some respects. But the liability model and the social connection model nevertheless differ in emphasis. On most occasions, the application of the liability model is backward-looking primarily, and the social connection model is more forward-looking. Under the liability model, The harm or circumstance for which we seek to hold agents responsible is usually an isolatable action or event that's reached a terminus. The robbery has taken place, or an oil tanker has spewed its contents on the beach. The deed is done. Usually the purpose of assigning responsibility in terms of blame or fault. Is to seek retribution or compensation for this past action. Such backward-looking condemnation and sanction may have a forward-looking purpose as well. It often aims to deter others from similar action in the future, or to identify weak points in an institutional system that allows or encourages such actions. Once we take this step, though, we may be entering the terrain of what I'm calling the social connection model. When conceptualizing responsibility in relation to structural injustice, on the other hand, we're concerned with an ongoing set of processes that we understand is likely to continue producing harms unless there are interventions in it. The temporality of assigning and taking responsibility, then, is more forward-looking than backward-looking. Because the particular causal relationship of the actions of particular individuals or organizations to structural outcomes is often not possible to trace, there's no point in seeking compensation or exacting redress. The injustices produced through structures haven't reached a terminus. The point is not to blame, punish, or seek redress, but rather to enjoin those who participate by their actions in the process of collective action to change it. The point is to change the structures. The two more conditions, the responsibilities shared and dischargeable only through collective action, and then I'm going to look forward to your questions and objections. From the observation that the social connection model differs from the liability model in that it doesn't isolate those liable in ways that implicitly absolve others, it follows that all who contribute by their actions to the structural processes produce injustice, that all who contribute to the processes that produce injustice share the responsibility for these harms. And here I draw on the work of Larry May, who distinguishes shared responsibility from collective responsibility. Shared responsibility, whereas collective responsibility, is that the collective as a whole is responsible, and then each individual has their own responsibility in relation to that collective, but it's still their own, or they have none. Shared responsibility is a personal responsibility that is had simultaneously. Each is personally responsible for the whole outcome, if you will, in a partial way, since he or she alone doesn't produce the outcome. It's not a division of labor, if you will. Once again, I can't trace my part. I know it's only a part, but I can't trace my part. So I have to accept the responsibility as shared with all the others. Finally, this means that my responsibility can only be discharged through collective action. This feature follows from the essentially shared nature of responsibility. Thousands or millions of agents contribute by our actions, in particular institutional contexts, to these processes that produce unjust outcomes. Our forward-looking responsibility consists in changing the institutions and processes so their outcomes will be unjust. But no one of us can do this on our own. Typically, a typical reaction to the anti-sweatshop movement is, okay, I don't want to be implicated, so I just won't buy anything that's made in sweatshops. Well, number one, it's very, very, very difficult not to buy anything made in sweatshops. And it's asking too much of ourselves. But part of the point is, even if you could, you wouldn't be changing the structures. All you'd be doing is taking yourself out of them as much as you can. In that that's a way of making stark that taking responsibility in relation to the structures can only be discharged by working with others together in organized form. Thus, responsibility from social connection is ultimately a political responsibility. What I mean by politics here, most fundamentally, is public communicative engagement with others for the sake of organizing our relationships and coordinating our actions most justly. So discharging my responsibility in relation to sweatshop workers might involve, for example, that I try to persuade others that these wrongs are unacceptable and that we collectively can alter social practices and institutional rules and priorities to prevent them. And one of the reasons I choose this example is I think there have been some modest successes in this direction with this movement, unlike many others you might name where the cause was just as just. Another important corollary of this feature of political responsibility is that many of those properly thought to be victims of harm or injustice nevertheless share such political responsibility in relation to it. On a liability model, it would be perverse to say that victims of the injustice are responsible. That's called blaming the victim, and it's wrong. But on the social connection model of responsibility, purported victims of injustice are part of the structures that produce the processes that produce the injustice. And victims are often in uniquely good positions to figure out some strategies for joining with others to change the structures. And in that sense, that's the sort of image I have in mind in saying the victims, too, share responsibility, not alone, but with others. I'm going to end there and want to listen to your questions and objections and alternative views.
You should maybe go ahead and call.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay, Alex, and then here, and then John.
I'm very sympathetic to the overall argument. I probably doesn't surprise you. But I guess as I was reading the paper, I kept wondering, where does responsibility stop? And given that your model problematizes background conditions, and given that in the real world, social connections ramify throughout the entire globe, and there aren't any boundaries around structures and that kind of thing, it sort of seems like in the end, all of us are responsible to everybody else all the time. And so you need to sort of draw boundary conditions around this to make it tractable. And so I guess I'm wondering, how do you think about that? It seems like there's a huge empirical question here about proximate and ultimate causes or something. I'm not sure. But so one question out of two has to do with sort of how you think about avoiding this problem of infinite responsibility. The other, and this picks up on the point you made at the end, you say that actors have a responsibility to change the structural injustice. And yet it seems by your own model, social connection, my responsibility for some problem comes from my participation in the processes that produce that problem. So why isn't it enough for me to simply stop buying sweatshop apparel? Why can't I simply withdraw from the system? I'm no longer connected anymore. And then in what sense am I still responsible for doing something more than that?
On your first question, the last section of the paper, which I didn't even touch on because I thought that I couldn't indulge your attention any longer, tries to begin to address that question. So where does responsibility end? I think about it in two ways. The first way is it doesn't. You're right. I mean, it is infinite, potentially, on this model. I think that's an objective truth. It might be an uncomfortable truth, but I think it's an objective truth that there is more that needs to be done than I can do. And there is more objectively that needs to be done than maybe any of us can do altogether. And one level at which I think of that is that I think it's useful to give pause to that objective truth and absorb it and be humble in the face of it. And I don't mean this in any kind of spiritualist sense, but I think it is part of recognizing how the world works. I do then, in that mode, think of this in somewhat existentialist terms, or in the terms like Emmanuel Levinas thinks about responsibility, where there is an infinity subjectively, what it means to be a subject, or sometimes I think of it in terms of Sartre, where responsibility, recognizing the first meaning of recognizing responsibility is that it produces anxiety. I think it is useful, theoretically and practically, to pause at that moment and admit it. But then, that is paralyzing. If one stops there, there's no action that would follow. One would just go, So that's why, in the rest of the paper, and in the larger project, I will try to devote an entire chapter to this question. Given that the responsibility is infinite, objectively speaking, how shall I think about my own action? Because the motivation of the question is, how shall we as individuals, even though it's a political relationship, think about our responsibilities in relation to structural injustice? So how shall I think about my own action? And there I've developed a set of parameters of reasoning, I call it. I'm not going to tell anybody what to do, and part of it remains existential in that I say, well, just because the responsibility is more than any of us can really properly respond to, completely respond to, then it is, in a real sense, our discretion what we do. We should do something, right? We're not discharging our responsibility if we say, oh, I can't even deal with this. But it's our discretion to look at our lives and figure out what we can do. And I do say part of this political responsibility is that it's my discretion, but on another meaning of responsibility, I am accountable to others with whom I share the responsibility to say why this is what I've chosen to do in respect to certain issues. Then the parameters of reason are meant to distinguish degrees and kinds of responsibility, and I haven't done this in what I've said today. Everyone shares responsibility, but if one follows it down, not in the same degree necessarily, or in the same respects. So differences of degree can correlate with differences of power, for example, in relation to a particular issue of injustice. Also can correlate with differences of ability or location. I think about the parameters of reasoning all in terms of structural positioning, location, in relation to whatever injustice we're talking about at the moment. And some people are better positioned to do something in relation to certain issues than others, either because of their work or the organizations they're connected to, and that's the direction. I'll answer your second question, and then you can tell me later whether you're satisfied with the answer to the first question. On the withdrawal, I alluded to the withdrawal question. And the issue there is, do you want to make yourself pure, or do you want to stop injustice? Withdrawal, should it be possible, can make an agent pure, and in that, pure, and in that sense, not responsible, not contributing any longer to producing the process that produces that injustice. There are certain injustices that are structural where you can reasonably say if everyone withdrew, then the injustice would disappear. I would claim that even in those cases, if you could find them, it will require collective organization for all those people to withdraw together to be effective. But there are other structural injustices that withdrawal just seems to, I would argue, have little effect on the outcome, even though it makes one pure. So,
can I get in, just because I didn't understand just the response to that. I thought you started by answering Alex's question by saying that there is no, as it were, way to limit the ramification of structures, and in fact, it's beyond all of our powers to be responsible. And then you started...
So I'm just not clear. So you thought I was saying the structures can't be changed?
No. I thought you were saying, in response to Alex, that indeed it is, as it were, infinite. And then I thought you said that insofar as it is infinite, it's not that John and Mike individually can't do it, it's that none of us could do it.
You mean withdrawal completely from every single process?
No, I mean be responsible. There's no sense of responsibility left under this infinite model. Did I miss something you said? How could there be any responsibility if this global holism, not just of action, but of all the structures?
Well, what I meant by the question here would be, what are we meaning by infinite? Maybe Alex meant something different from what I was meaning, and we could ask him. What I mean is, there is more to be done. There is more injustice, potentially, than the existing time and energy could properly and fully address. Now, I don't think that way of thinking about infinite, if you will.
You mean even collectively?
That's what I thought.
Potentially. It might be true.
It might be true.
That doesn't mean there is no progress that can be made from particularly unjust to less unjust, right? It would only mean, unless redressing injustice means that we must eliminate all injustice from the world, then there's plenty of responsibility to be discharged to make the world less unjust, right?
Well, I jumped in, so I'll stop and let Bill get to his question.
Yes.
It's a different question.
Okay, well, yeah, but you've been waiting a while.
I have an objection to the way that you characterize your specific example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where the ramifications for this lead, but let me just raise the objection and then we'll see. When you talk about sweatshops, you don't talk about the element of time and of change or progress or resolution of problems over time. And yet, for anybody who has been in East Asia over the last half century or so, what we've seen is that sweatshops were a base on which a modern economy was developed. I was in Singapore for the first time in the early 1960s, and I remember walking down the street and having pointed out to me above the shops that people were sleeping 10 or 20 in a room and indeed only had that bed for a certain portion of time during the day because they would go out and work and then somebody else would sleep in the bed and so forth. I mean, these were really appalling conditions in Singapore at that time. Yet if you go to Singapore today, of course, Singapore is a fully modern society that started out with this very low level of productivity, which produced those very low wages, but of course they built on that. Now, that's not at all, you are atemporal entirely in the way in which you look at this, so that you can't factor in this element of structure producing justice when you use that particular example. And I'll just conclude this by saying, the guy who is most responsible, the most morally responsible in Singapore, as far as I know, is Lee Kuan Yew, the Prime Minister of Singapore for a very long time, who of course gets a bad press, sometimes for good reasons, but who is also, more than any other single individual, the person who had the vision that started the sweatshops and turned them into something else. And that model has been followed in lots of other places in Asia.
Well, here we have empirical issues, as I hear them, not normative ones. But it does seem that you're wanting to draw a normative conclusion, as I hear it.
Well, because the normative case leads, I think that was why I said there are ramifications here that I haven't figured out exactly, but when you characterize it without the temporal element, you make conclusions about the consequences of structure and so forth that I think are unwarranted.
Well, it seems this certainly opens itself up to a long empirical discussion. Right. I hear you suggesting, briefly, that what I'm calling sweatshops are the normal beginnings of a capitalist economy anywhere, and that by inevitable processes of social and economic development...
There are agents in here, too, and that's why I threw them into it.
Just the point. I mean, if it's not inevitable... then the process, I hear you suggesting that there are normal processes of development that start with sweatshops
and end with good. We have some evidence that they have worked. I don't know if they're normal or not, but they've worked.
Well, as soon as, now it's becoming more and more accidental. If it's contingent.
No, it's agent driven.
If Singapore is contingent, which I think it is, then I don't think that you can draw what I hear as your normative conclusion, which is, therefore, sweatshops are not unjust.
I just throw one more thing in this, which is that I think there is a difference, as I listen to you talking, I think the implication of the way that I see it is that it's not good to force people not to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be good to keep the wages at $1 a day.
And you notice I did make that distinction.
Well, you kind of elided it. It's not
I meant to make it as a big distinction. And when I alluded to it, I think it's a different issue. Now, I'm not sure I agree with you on the issue, but I do agree that it's a different issue. That and I also am critical of many portions of the anti-sweatshop movement on this. I think there's been too much focus on wages, where it is plausible to say, what is a just wage in a given place at a given time is going to be necessarily a variable. It's not across. How to answer the question, what's a just wage, as distinct from the one being paid at this time, I think that's still a distinction that should be made. But I think it's quite a different matter from sleep and bathrooms, right? So those are... Now, let me say something else about time. You notice that I talked about sweatshops in Chicago and Los Angeles, and I wasn't being sensationalist there. Andrew Ross's book on one of Andrew Ross's many books on this subject talks about Italy today. I'm not talking in the early 20th century. And when people talk about sweatshops in Los Angeles, they're talking about now, right? So some of the empirical work that's been done on this is asking the questions not how did the modern high wage for everyone capitalist economy develop out of the sweatshop. Now they're at that. That question might have been asked about most of the world or a good part of the world in 1956. But now people are asking, how has the sweatshop returned? And that puts a different spin on your story. So what I do agree with about your story is that agency in some place like Singapore matters. And I would argue that we'd have to ask, do I think all of that agency is good? Probably I don't. But to the extent that there has been in Singapore a priority on individual welfare and a priority on keeping economic inequality to a relative minimum compared to the rest of the world, that has been decision, it's been a political decision, and I agree with it. And the same is true of the history of South Korea, as far as I know. But there are exceptions, it seems to me, in the world. John.
I want to ask about the part of the theory that says that the social connection model is more forward-looking than backward-looking. And this, I think, touches on a part of Cox's question. What I want to ask is whether that feature of it is sort of is necessarily connected to the other features of it, or whether it's separable. That is, is it just the case that you want additionally to have a forward-looking theory, or is it the case that that's tied up with the other issues? Let me try and illustrate. Suppose I'm differentiating between two kinds of responsibilities. One is sort of a guilt or innocence responsibility, and another is a sort of ought-to responsibility, forward-looking. The two may be entirely unconnected. For example, I'm standing near a lake. I see someone hit someone off it. They fall into the water. The person screams, "I can't swim." At the moment they scream, "I can't swim," my responsibility to save them is not differentiated from the person on the bridge, even though they knocked them in. If I'm closer, I should help out. I think that can apply at a collective action level the same way. For example, say we had sort of enlightened cousins of Canadians or Swedes, but they live in the tropical realm, and we'll call them sort of the people of Nakedia. And the people of Nakedia don't really wear clothes. They make what little they need, but just sort of for cultural reasons for a long time, they haven't ever worn clothes, and consequently, they haven't contributed in the least to the sweatshop industry. But suppose that the kind of action that Sweden or Canada might take as a nation state is for some reason of them doing trade or something, something that the people of Nakedia could do as well. Are they any less responsible in the ought to sense for taking that action than the people of Sweden or Canada?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it makes you, to me, look like the Peter Singer and Peter Unger that I cite in the paper.
Well, maybe just with respect to the ought to part. I mean, because I agree with you absolutely about the social connection model being a better way of characterizing the guilt or innocence part.
Mm-hmm. Well, the distinction I want to make, I think that if I can turn you into Peter Unger or Peter Singer for a moment.
That would really improve our ratings.
We actually would like you to.
John, may I answer John Parrish's question? There's one position. That position I take, one formulation of that position is, when there is a wrong, well, in this case it doesn't even have to be an injustice, right? It could be just a bad thing happened. Somebody's suffering. When there is suffering, those who are aware of the suffering and are in a position to do something about it ought to, period. Don't need any social connection. It's just about human need and human relationship. And I think if one might, on the one hand, I can't object to such a thing. It's what duty to aid is in moral theory. That's what the duty to aid means. And at one level, of course, there is a duty to aid. However, if we try to assimilate all the wrongs and suffering in the world under that model, then I think it's even more demanding than what Alex thought mine was. And it's harder to differentiate. Maybe I can, but there's so many things I can, but I can only with some things, because then I'll be out of money or out of time or whatever. So I think it's better to have levels. There's a duty to aid, or a kind of cosmopolitan duty that everyone owes everyone, that has a kind of emergency quality. It's not a standing duty, if you will. And Peter Unger, for example, in his book, makes it all a standing duty, right? Even though he conceptualizes it a lot in terms of emergency. But the duty of aid is not a standing duty. It kicks in when there's an emergency, if you will. However, structural injustice is normal. It's ongoing. And if we think about it that way, then I think it's useful, besides all the reasons I've given about connection, to make conceptually speaking, the scope of those who have the obligations narrower than all of humanity. Whereas, even though in practice, for some issues, it might be all of humanity. And for people to reason in terms of the other thing that the model adds, that I think often the duty to aid model is very agency based, quite individualist in some respects, in the sense that it imagines, even Unger when he talks, and Singer when he talks as though one individual is doing one thing that somehow percolates out to aid the suffering others. And what's missing from the theory is what's the process by which the aid has its positive effect, and that's social structures. So that, I think, is also added. Now, your question, though, said something about why is it necessarily forward-looking? And you began with that, but I didn't see that in the, how you spun it out, right, that part got spun.
Well, I suppose what I meant was I was suggesting that the forward-looking feature of it doesn't depend, that is to say, the duties that arise out of that don't necessarily depend on a certain model on attributing social connection responsibility for structural injustice at all. That's mm-hmm. where I was.
Okay. And now here we can, there's a difference between one way that I could alleviate the suffering of workers who I think are working under conditions that violate their human rights is I could go somewhere, find them, and with my resources, set them up. Give them a few thousands. In some of these places, it wouldn't take more than a few thousand dollars for me to release an individual from this condition, right? And that would be one form of duty to aid. But it's not, that's kind of the obverse of withdrawal. It's still focusing on individuals rather than structures. And it's still only one person. I haven't, with all my resources that I think I can afford, I can only save two people from this condition. And that's not addressed structures. So the reason that the model is necessarily forward-looking is because the project of taking responsibility involves trying to alter the structures. And that's internal to what the responsibility involves. Please.
I want to ask you about enforcing this responsibility. It seems to me that one big difference between the model of responsibility, your idea of responsibility and liability, is precisely that there is some kind of enforcement mechanism. And infinite responsibilities have a tendency to dilute to the point where they lose completely all meaning. And so, my question is, how do you see this responsibility as enforcing itself, other than just calling one another to accountability? And to what extent isn't there the need for a return to institutions, not necessarily the domestic institutions that Miller starts with, but some form of non-national and more global institution that will compel some kind of action? And it strikes me that this makes your project in a way narrower and a lot less ambitious than Vitus' project, who envisions, I think the way I read him, he's envisioning a certain justification for institutions with a global position, and of course Pogge with the system of taxation. So very concrete, very demanding, very much backed up by power. And
okay, I want to say a couple of things in response. First, I want to I was probably wrong to accede to the idea of infinity. People are hearing it as we all have to do everything all at once. And I think that the anti-sweatshop movement is very instructive for thinking in those terms. That is, for countering that mm-hmm. reaction. It is a big problem. But concrete steps have been designed and developed by this movement that involve both somewhat state actors, somewhat international actors like the International Labor Organization, and a lot of small NGO-type actors or people-to-people civic relationships. The construction, for example, that student movement that involved it in, brought into being the Workers' Rights Consortium as an institution. It's a non-governmental organization with mostly with members that are universities and other such institutions that pay dues as membership dues. It has a staff that's engaged both in monitoring education and to some extent, as I understand it, organizing, in the sense that one of the criticisms they had of the Fair Labor Association was that they didn't actually work with workers, right? That workers would be interviewed on site, for example. So there are connections with civic organizations in the places where workers are that are able to work in solidarity with the North American entities in NGO relationships that make some difference to the possibility for unionization for in particular places. Structural change, as I'm conceiving it here, isn't an all-at-once kind of thing. It would be nice. I'd be for it if it could be done. But it's about forming, to some extent, civic networks, but linked to state action. I don't think any of the people who are involved in this movement abjure cooperating with states. Now, in the long run, what it means to discharge, to take collective action in order to undermine structural injustice and make more just structures, I think must involve state institutions, state-like institutions, whether at a very local level, middle level, or international level. And I think that there are already in existence in the world some regulatory institutions that have state-like functions, although they're not very strong. And I consider in some ways this work, when I'm thinking about global justice, as a complement to the kind of claims. I don't see actually Bites calling for any institutions, but maybe I haven't read the most recent stuff. Poggett, for sure, has been pretty specific. And there are people, some of the most interesting people I read on this are part of the Network Institute on Global Democracy, whose base is in Helsinki, and are calling for even more specific institutions, but not like the big world state. My motivation in this work is partly inspired by what I see as a withdrawal of state action, even at the domestic level, about issues that I consider to be about structural injustice. And part of the motivation is that I think many of us as citizens are inclined to say there's an injustice. Well, the state should do something. It's the state that's responsible. But this work is motivated by a further question. And exactly who is the state? What enables the state to correct structural injustice? Well, there's a sense in which citizenship, to come to the theme of this lecture series, is required to enable state institutions to come into existence and to do their work. So I think of it as, I do support, and in some other writing I've done, I've been explicit about this, stronger global governance and regulatory institutions. And one way of thinking about the collective action I'm calling for here, that is the way of discharging, is that the state is the way of discharging collective action.
At this point, I don't want to stop our discussion, but relocate it to the next room where there is wine and cheese and all kinds of food. And, of course, to thank Ira for the... please do join us. We have a reception set up outside.
So how's it going?
I'm interested in the kind of French notion of collective versus personal responsibility.
authorities as opposed to Part of what I'm on a few right here is how reasonable that is.
All right.
If you want to send me more objections,
I have more comments.
Thank you.
I'm Alan.